Scripture reading this morning be Proverbs 5, 1 through 6. Proverbs 5, 1 through 6. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion and your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life, her ways are unstable, you do not know them.
We've been going through the book of Proverbs for a little bit now. And we have gotten through chapter 4 and into chapter 5. And if you look at each chapter, at least until you get to chapter 10, it's actually a sermon series by Solomon being written to his son or sons, which in the context is not necessarily biological sons, but it could also be those who are like sons, because during Solomon's time, he would actually teach and train smaller rulers that he could trust and place them as city-states throughout all of Israel. And although he was the king, he would have trained men with the same knowledge of wisdom that he received, because he taught them himself. And so as he was teaching them how to be a good ruler, how to be wise in your business and how to be honest in your business, who to listen to and who not to take counsel in. If you look throughout all of Proverbs, a key lesson from a father to his son or sons, or those who were like, he always somehow brings up the strange woman, as is said in the King James Version. Some English translations will say the adulteress. If you look in the Hebrew, it literally means this word strange. It can be cross-referenced to Leviticus chapter 10, when Nadab and Abihu were actually offering up strange fire. And the word there literally means unauthorized. So what Solomon is teaching them is you need to stay away from a woman that you are not authorized to be around, because she will take you down and she will murder you. Not necessarily physically, although that may be the case. He says spiritually, you're gone if you hang out with these types of women. Something that I am very thankful for in my lifetime. My father, faithful man, showed me what it was like and also taught me what it was like to be a faithful husband and a faithful father. And something that I appreciate my father doing was sitting me down and talking with me straightforward about things that a lot of Christian men are kind of afraid or embarrassed to discuss. And if you look at a lot of families that try to refrain from discussing about things of private nature, things that should be discussed with reverence and respect, going to the scriptures and discussing it, they say, well, they'll figure it out. And if a parent, specifically a father, has that kind of a mindset with their children and their sons, guess who's going to be the one to teach them about married life? It's going to be Satan. And Solomon is teaching his sons and those who are like his son, saying, I'm not going to let the world try to teach you what a good woman is supposed to be like. I'm not going to allow the adversary to infiltrate my household
and try to draw my sons away and say, why don't you go hang out with these types of women? You can figure it out. Your father, look, he wasn't perfect. And so he knows what a young man is like. And so just go out, experiment, enjoy life. That's the kind of teaching that our children are going to receive if we don't step in and teach them the way God has intended us to teach them. And if you look at chapter 5, we have titled it The Fountain of Wisdom. The Fountain of Wisdom. Solomon loves to talk in parables or in symbolism. And in Proverbs chapter 5, he discusses a marriage much like a fountain. He says there are some fountains that are poisonous, some fountains that are dangerous. Some fountains, he says, are personal. They ought not to be shared with multiple people. It should only be your fountain. And he says there's another type of fountain. It is a fountain of blessings. You should enjoy your fountain and receive the blessings from your fountain, not anybody else's fountain, because there are some forbidden fountains. And in those forbidden fountains, there is wickedness, wicked fountains. Now, let's consider these types of fountains in Proverbs chapter 5 and see what the inspired writer Solomon is teaching us as well as his sons. In verses 1 to 6, you have the poisonous fountain. Verses 7 to 14, the dangerous fountain. 15 to 17, a personal fountain. 18 to 19, a blessed fountain. In verse 20, Solomon says, there is, however, the forbidden fountain. And 21 to 23, it is a wicked fountain. Now look at verses 1 to 7, or 1 to 6 rather. It says, my son, give attention to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding, that you may observe discretion and your lips may reserve knowledge. For the lips of the adulteress drip honey, and smoother than oil is her speech. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold of Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways are unstable, and she does not know it. If you look at just his introduction alone, there are three things that Solomon touches on to prepare his sons, his children, for what the world has to offer for spouses. He says in verses 1 to 2, number 1, heed the warning of a sincere father and incline your ear. Heed the warning of a sincere father and incline your ear. Children, those who are under your parents' roofs, I beg you, listen to your parents. Listen to what they have to say. Give heed to even your grandparents and glean knowledge from them for the life that they have lived. Nobody is perfect. Your parents are not perfect. Your grandparents aren't perfect. You aren't perfect. And you know what I said, that I love my father and he is a faithful man? You know, my father is not perfect. My grandfather is not. Nobody is perfect. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And Solomon is saying, look, I have lived a life. I have money, I have power, and I have time. All three things that you need in order to experiment with life to the fullest. And Solomon would say in the book of Ecclesiastes, anything that I wanted or my body or my mind desired, I did not withhold from it. Solomon was an addict. And he fulfilled desires in ways that God did not approve of. And he is telling his sons, his children, do not do what I did. There are things in my life, Solomon said, that I'm not proud of. Now, I can be forgiven of those things, but I'm trying to help you not make the same mistakes I did. Heed the warning of a sincere father. Unfortunately, there are a lot of parents out there who are not sincere, and they are not warning their children like they're supposed to. there should be a very unique relationship and even friendship to a degree between a father or parents and their children. And if a father cannot sit down with his son or a mother with her daughter or parents with their children and cannot explain and describe and warn the things of which the world has to offer and say, this is what God wants of a marriage, then you need to work on your relationship with your children. Because if you as a father or you as the mother are not building a relationship with your children where you can have these types of conversations like Solomon with his, guess who their parent is going to be? Their parent or their father figure is going to be the one that's trying to devour them like a roaring lion. Notice 3 and 4. Her words are sweet at first, but inwardly they're bitter. It is very easy for a young man to become enticed. In fact, if you jump over to chapter 7, we haven't gotten there yet, but all of chapter 7 is again another warning from Solomon to his sons about the dangers of loose women, unauthorized women, the adulteress. Notice what Solomon says in verse 6 of chapter 7. For at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive and discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense, passing through the street near her corner, and he takes the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness. And behold, a woman comes to meet him dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. She is boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner. Notice how Solomon describes this type of woman. She's hunting. She is hiding in the shadows, waiting for a naive young man. You know, I find it fascinating how at the beginning of the book, he describes what women are not to be, away from home, hunting, in the shadows, trying to pick out the naive. And if you keep reading in chapter 7, she'll try to seduce him by saying, my husband has left me to go in a faraway land. He's taken all the money. There's nobody to protect me. There's nobody to provide for me. You are my savior. You're the only one that can provide for me. So while my husband is away, not providing like he's supposed to, he doesn't show me any love. He doesn't fulfill his husband duties. And so I've got a bed prepared. I've got it covered in rose petals. I've got it doused in the best oils from Egypt, the finest linens of the South. Why don't you come over and we can have our fill of love? That's what she's saying. But then if you look in Proverbs 31, you see the exact opposite. This woman in Proverbs 7 and Proverbs chapter 5, she's boisterous, she's loud, she's trying to use her words in a way that is very toxic and bitter. But the woman in Proverbs 31, she's modest in apparel as well as attitude and temperament. She's working at home. She's providing for her children. And rather than her being out on the streets trying to talk to men, her husband is in the gates talking to men saying, there are many daughters of Israel, but there is none like my wife. You see a complete difference and what a woman is supposed to be versus what a woman is not supposed to be. You see exactly what a man is supposed to look for versus what a man is supposed to stay away from. Her words are sweet at first, but after a while, you realize there's an aftertaste to the words, and it's very bitter, and it'll actually bring you death. Look at verses 5 through 6. Her ways, stability, and fate are inevitably deadly. Notice what it says, verses 5 through 6. Her feet go down to death and her steps take hold of Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life and her ways are unstable. She does not know it. The world says that you can live a life and sow your wild oats and get to know the world and do whatever you want. Live life while you're young. Because once you're older, you will regret all the opportunities that were handed to you. So live life to the fullest. Solomon is saying living life to the fullest, as the world says, is what's called an unstable life. A woman that says, you can be with me and we can go do whatever we want. And you know what? You can, after you're done with me, you can go with anybody else. And when I'm done with you, I can go with anybody else. That is the most unstable relationship that you could ever have. And the world says that's the most freeing and the most fulfilling. If you look at what a marriage is actually supposed to be, according to Genesis chapter 2, all the way even into Matthew chapter 19, a man is to leave his father and mother, and he shall join to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Have you ever thought, you know, I'm tired of this arm, so I'm just going to cut it off, and I'm going to go try and find another arm and attach it to me. When I'm done with that one, I'm going to cut it off, and then I'm going to go try and find another arm. Well, that's the most ridiculous thing you've probably ever heard in your life. Well, how come we do that with marriages? How come we do that with our relationships with who we think is our soulmate? Well, I'll be with this person and marry them. Oh, well, it's not what I want. So I'm just going to tear asunder what God has joined together, which no man is supposed to tear asunder. And then I'm going to go and try and find somebody else to become one flesh with. And if that one doesn't work out, then that's okay. I can just go find somebody else. All that does is lead to death. And you know what? Unfortunately, I've experienced it with my own eyes. There are people within the Lord's church that think if they can just pray to God and say, Lord, forgive me, that God says, you know what? Since you said you're sorry, I will approve of this marriage, even though it was an adulterous marriage at one point. I'll say it's okay. Or even those who are in adulterous marriage, and then they come to the knowledge of the truth of the gospel, and they say, well, you know what? Blood of Christ washes away all sins. It should wash away the sinfulness of this marriage. So I'll just do that, and then our marriage will be good. Baptism does not condone sin or validate something that is sinful. It washes it away, gets it out, if you stop doing it. Solomon says, don't even begin the process, because later on, he'll say momentarily, you'll regret it later. And you'll try to find every excuse in the book, and all you'll do is drain yourself. Don't even start the process. Look at verses 7 to 14, the dangerous fountain. 7 to 14, the dangerous fountain. It says in verses 7 and 8, now then, my sons, that was just introduction material from Solomon. Now he's actually getting into the meat of the lesson. Now then, my sons, listen to me and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house, or you will give your vigor to others and your years to the cruel one. Look at verse 10. And strangers will be filled with your strength, and your hard-earned goods will go to the house of an alien. And when you groan at your final end, when your flesh and your body are consumed, and you say, how have I hated instruction, and my heart spurned reproof? I have not listened to the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to my instructors. I was almost in utter ruin in the midst of the assembly and the congregation. Solomon paints a picture of what it's like to live in an adulterous marriage. The world says it's not that big a deal. It's just a way of life. If it doesn't work out, it wasn't meant to be. And then the world tries to sugarcoat these things and say it's really just a part of growing up. Notice how Solomon describes what the world says is just growing up. Verses 7 and 8, stay away from it. Stay far away from her. Don't even go to the house. Remember Proverbs chapter 7? He says, I was looking at my house one day, and I saw a bunch of stupid young men think that they can walk past this loose woman's house and think, it's not going to affect me any. How many, I don't want to raise the hands, I just want you to think about this, men and women, how many of you, as well as myself, have thought, this isn't going to bother me? I can watch this movie. I can watch this TV show. I can listen to this music and it won't bother me. It won't affect me. I can hang out with these types of people. I know they dress a certain way. I know they are living a certain lifestyle. It's not going to affect me any. Did it not affect you? Are you somehow just immune to sin? Do you have some sort of superpower that nobody else does? Because if you do, I'd certainly like to know about it. Jesus is the only one that was able to overcome temptation. Do you want to know why he was able to do that? Because he stayed away from it. He didn't say, well, you know what? Because I'm the Son of God, this isn't going to bother me. It says he was tempted in all manners such as we, yet without sin. Jesus understood the proverb that said, stay away from a house that is not yours. Do not go near the woman that you are not authorized to go to. Jesus said, you know what? I actually have a bride that my Father has given me, chosen for me specifically, and I'm going to be true to her, and I will even die for her. Jesus is the perfect example of the fulfillment of staying away from a loose woman and being truthful and faithful to the bride of your youth. You know, we also see this throughout the Old Testament. Stay away from her. One of my favorite examples of this is Joseph. Growing up, and even now, as a young man, with what the world has to offer and what it shoves down our throats every single day, I appreciate Joseph. Because it says that day after day, Potiphar's wife would create situations to where they could be alone. And it was day after day after day after day. And you know what Joseph said? How can I do this and sin against my God? He says, if I have to give up things to get out of this situation, I will. She physically grabbed him and said, I want you to have this relationship with me. And Joseph said, take my coat, I'm out of here. That is what our response should be every single time, not just to these types of people, but to sin. And notice, even in the New Testament, Paul says, flee sexual immorality, 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18. The church at Corinth, going through preaching school, there are benefits of going through preaching school. There are benefits of having a one-on-one mentorship. One of the benefits of going through a preaching school is the school has resources to where congregations will reach out and say, we need help. We need a preacher to labor with us and help serve. And the school will let the young preachers know and say, hey, if you're looking for a work, here's a congregation. Here's their phone number. Go get to know them and build a relationship with them. Well, a bad habit that a lot of the young preachers do, and I say young preachers because I'm one of those, when you're in school and you receive information that there is a congregation looking for a preacher because a preacher retired, a preacher moved on, or whatever the situation is, and you know of the congregation, and it's one of those that's like everybody wants to be at that congregation. That is a preacher's dream, is to be at that congregation. And then there are some congregations that, unfortunately, young preachers will look at and be like, let me go tell my buddy about this one. I think I'll pass on this one. Corinth is one that if Corinth called up a school, said, we need a preacher, and the instructor said, guys, Corinth needs a preacher, nobody would answer. Nobody wanted to go to Corinth. Corinth was a terrible place to be, and the congregation there was just as corrupt. But Paul said, Titus, you're the man for the job. I left you in Crete to set order what remains and appoint elders in every city, and they must be like God, one who cannot lie. But also, Titus, this is what you have to work with. Liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. Good luck. Here's the template of which you need to follow. Well, that was Crete. But you know, he also worked at Corinth as well. Crete and Corinth were two of some of the most difficult works, and Titus had the courage to go to both of them. And if you read in Corinth and 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18, they were doing things that the Gentiles said, we don't even do those things. The church was saying, well, look, that's just brother so-and-so. It's just family drama. He took his father's wife, but we don't really talk about it. But he's a good brother in Christ. He's been here for a while, family friend. So we're just going to accept him. And Paul says, absolutely not. I've already delivered him over to Satan, and I'm not even there yet. You need to be working on some church discipline, and you need to get the sin out of the camp. Now notice verse 9. Not only stay away from her, give away your honor for her. If you do not heed the information that the instructor is giving here, Solomon, he says, if you decide to go past her house, this is what you have to look forward to. The first thing you're going to do is give your honor up. Notice what he says. I'm in verse 9. He says, or you will give your vigor to others, some translations say honor, and your years to the cruel one. There is a famous saying, sin takes you farther than you want to go. It costs you more than you're willing to pay, and it keeps you longer than you're willing to stay. That's what you have to look forward to if you go past somebody of this description. Somebody whose words are like honey and their lips are like oil, but inwardly they're bitter as wormwood. He says it will cost you your strength. It'll cost you your dignity. It'll cost you your reputation. It'll cost you your wealth. It'll cost you opportunities in life. And it will cost you years of life. There's an old song by the Oak Ridge Boys. Trying to love two women is like a ball and chain. If you listen to those words, the lifestyle that band is describing, he's saying it's exhausting. It takes my strength away. I'm tired all the time. I'm trying to cover up the lies. It's not worth it. He said, that's exactly what Solomon is saying. It's not worth it. For one night of pleasure, you're going to give up an entire life of opportunities, of strength, of reputation, of honor. He says, that's why chapter 7, they're naive. They're stupid. Because they're not thinking clearly. Then you've got verse 10. Others enjoy what you have earned. Notice what he says. And strangers will be filled with your strength, and your hard-earned goods will go to the house of an alien. You know, have you ever seen somebody cheat on their wife, and then they go through a divorce period, and they have to split up everything, and then the husband, he loses everything? Everything goes to somebody else. Perhaps in order to pay for certain bills and lawyer fees and all of these things, he has to sell some of his things to pay it off. Solomon says it's not worth it. You'll lose everything. He also says in verse 11 to 13, regret comes later. It's all good and fun right now, but just wait till later comes. You know, nobody talks about later. They always talk about now. Now is such a fun company because it's here right now. You can talk about it, you can enjoy it, but nobody likes to talk about later. But when later comes, it's not fun. Notice what he says in verses 11 to 13. He says, and you groan at your final end, and when your flesh and your body are consumed, and you say, how I have hated instruction, and my heart is spurned reproof, I have not listened to the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to my instructors. You know, you may have a good time for a very short amount of time. As instead of Moses, he did not partake in those things that was fulfilling but for a season. Moses knew this is going to be fun, but it's only going to last for a little while. Let me tell you something.
It's fun. It's enjoyable. It's pleasurable. But just for a little while. Solomon says, look, I've got about 1,000 women. I can tell you, it's a lot of fun for a little while, but then it puts a toll on you. You start losing days and months and years of your life. You're strained. You're being pulled in multiple directions. You're trying to cover up with more lies. He says, just follow the pattern that God gives and just love one woman. Look at verse 14, public shame. Ultimately, it gets down to public shame. It was almost in utter ruin in the midst of the assembly and the congregation. You know, it takes 20, 30, 40, 50 years for a little oak sapling to grow into a full, strong oak tree. But it takes probably an hour or less to cut down 50 years worth of growth. And once you cut it down, you can't put it back. It's gone. You can try and replant, but guess what? It's going to take another 50 years. That's the same way with the reputation. It takes years to build, but only seconds to ruin. And once it gets public, and trust me, it will, that you may think that you've gotten away with it. You may have thought that you've gotten away with it in this life, and it's gone to your grave, but guess what? On the day of judgment, when everything is brought to light, not only is it going to be everybody that you knew that knows about it, it's going to be everybody that has ever lived knows about it. Do you really want that to hang over you for all of eternity? He says, I was in utter ruin when I was with the congregation. It ruins lives. It ruins years of lives. And then he says in verses 15 and 17, so, therefore, just enjoy your wife. Don't worry about anybody else's wife. That's none of your business. It's not any of your authority. You love your own wife. Notice singular. Verses 15 to 17, a personal fountain. He says, drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Verse 15, he says, have your own wife. Have your own wife and don't have somebody else's wife. Verse 16, she is no one else's wife but yours. In the same way, you ought not to be playing with somebody else's wife. Don't let anybody else play with your wife. Don't let anybody else try to have a conversation and say, well, why don't we just try to get out of town and it just be you and me? You protect and guard your wife. In verse 17, not only do you protect and guard, you cherish her. You protect your wife. You cherish her. Verse 17, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. You know, this culture in this world says, you know what? This is your body, your choice. Even if you're married, it's still your body. That's wrong. Once you're married, your body is your spouse's. And your spouse's body is yours. Well, that's just terrible. What do you mean? That seems like, that sounds like submission. And I'm an independent individual and I get to say what happens to my body. I get to choose. Well, according to the laws of marriage that Jehovah God put in place, the two shall become one flesh, and they shall be each other's helpmate. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and chapter 7 discuss how the wife's body is the husband's and the husband's body is the wife. You don't withhold yourself. You have made a vow and a commitment to your spouse that you are going to be theirs and theirs alone. You do not say, well, even though I made a vow, I'm going to break it just this once so I can enjoy some time outside the marriage. There, unfortunately, are people who think that this is a healthy marriage. There is I don't even know where I saw this. It was a couple that
wanted to have an open relationship. It was a married couple. And this married couple, they said, okay, well, here's some, you know, we're going to have ground rules, and which I think is absolutely crazy to say. We're going to have ground rules for what's chaos. We're going to have ground rules on an open relationship, and you get to choose who you want to be with, and I get to choose who I want to be with. Well, in searching for their open relationship partner, they found another couple who wanted to have the same thing. So what they did, they became really good friends. They went on double dates. They exchanged spouses, and then it eventually became where, you know what, why don't we all just get married and become one big happy family, a four-group marriage. I'm not making this up. This is, they've interviewed this, I don't even know what you call it. It's an abomination, really. They interview and say, tell us about this lifestyle. It's so unique. And they describe it in such a way that it's like, wow, this is new. This is groundbreaking. We've got to introduce this to our young people and say how freeing you can be. It's disgusting. It's terrible. And it goes against God's law. And notice verses 18 and 19. In your personal fountain, it's a blessed fountain. There are so many benefits that come with marriage. And I'm not talking about the physical aspect. There are so many things that you can get out of marriage, mentally, emotionally, spiritually speaking. And Solomon says, look, there, even though you can receive those things in a marriage, spiritual, mental, emotional benefits, there is a physical aspect to marriage that God has created, and it is supposed to be enjoyed only within the marriage period. Notice what he says, verses 18 and 19. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth as a loving hind or a stag in some translations, and a graceful doe or a deer. Let her breast satisfy you at all times, be exhilarated always with her love. This is what's called poetic language. It's actually mentioned again in Song of Solomon, chapter 2, in verse 9, in verse 17, also in chapter 4 and chapter 7. You know, I think it's kind of fascinating how Song of Solomon is an inspired book of the Bible, and it's one that we talk about the least because it's kind of embarrassing. It's kind of, you know, what we might say is kind of scandalous. You know, it's about a couple dating that's trying to preserve their purity for each other. And then when they get married, you have the married scene, and then you have conflict, and then they reunite, and you see what a marriage is supposed to be like. And you know who wrote that? God wrote that. He's writing to his children saying, this is what a marriage is supposed to be like. And yet we've got Christian parents that say, they'll figure it out for themselves. Notice what Solomon says. He describes a marriage as supposed to be like a young doe and a young buck during the springtime. You know, I've been hunting many times. And even when I'm not hunting, when I'm just out in the woods and enjoying nature, sometimes you'll see some deer. Sometimes you'll see different animals. And sometimes you'll see one buck and one doe, and they're running around playing with each other. They kind of go up to each other and poke noses, and they kind of do this right here, and they run around, look, see if the other one's following. And they have no idea that I'm there. And I could be as close to them as I am this pew, and they have no idea that I'm even here. That's the kind of relationship Solomon is talking about. You need to have a relationship with your spouse that you forget everybody else around you. You don't worry about somebody else's spouse. You be like a doe and a buck during the springtime when they're frolicking in the woods, and they forget about everything and everyone. That's what a marriage is supposed to be like. You know, when Haley and I were going through marriage counseling, and after we got married, they'd say, have y'all had y'all's first fight yet? And it was like, why are you so excited about us and our first fight? What was it? What was your first fight about? They're so excited about the fight, but they don't want to talk about, you know, what life are y'all building? Tell us about your life. Tell us what it's like being married. They say, how many times have you fought over which side of the bed is yours? What, have you fought of which color you're going to paint the living room? Have you fought about that yet? It's coming. It's coming. No, it's not. Not if I have anything to say about it. You know, when we, in our first year of marriage, we were in school and instructors picked on us so much. They said, oh, you're going through the honeymoon phase. Don't worry, that passes. And I thought, bless your wife's heart. I mean, good night. Like, is your marriage just bitter? You know, oh, it'll go away. Trust me. Why? You know, I understand at the beginning, at first, no one can do any wrong. But a marriage is not about having a Hallmark type marriage at the first 2 years and then everything is just like, wow, I can't believe it's the old ball and chain over here. That's not how a marriage is supposed to be. A marriage is supposed to be hard work and effort. And you know what? If you truly love your spouse as the stag and the doe are described here, those that frolic like the doe and enjoy the marriage in their first year could also enjoy the marriage in their 50th and 60th and even 70th year. A marriage can be fun and beneficial and loving if you put in the work. Same way with the church and Jesus the Christ. You know what? Times are hard. There's persecution. But I love my husband, Jesus the Christ. He cares for me. He loves me. He protects me. He cherishes me. He's preparing a place for me in his Father's house so that I can live with him for all of eternity. There are going to be hard days, but it makes you appreciate the good days even more because it forces you to either work together or work against each other. And God says you work with each other because y'all are helpmates. Now, we're out of time, unfortunately. So what I'll do is I will use these last 2 points as concluding points. Notice real quick before we get on to our two concluding points. Notice the word that's mentioned in verse 19, be exhilarated always with her love. The word in Hebrew there, exhilarated, means literally intoxicated. You are intoxicated by her love. It, in the literal sense, it means to be drawn away. But notice, every time usually that's used, that's usually in a negative sense, intoxicated, being drawn away. This is being used in a positive sense. You, the only one that should draw you away into the marriage bed, Hebrews chapter 12 and 13, is your wife. The only one that you should enjoy the love of is your wife. But then he also uses the same word in verse 20, a forbidden fountain. He says, for why should you, my son, be exhilarated, intoxicated, drawn away with the adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? Why should you go out and find love somewhere else when you have love right here? It doesn't make any sense. You know, I had somebody tell me, and it's one of the most insightful sayings I've ever heard because they shed a lot of light on it. You know, grass is always greener on the other side. Well, I forget which conversation it was specifically. I was talking to an elder of the Lord's church about something a long time ago. And we were having a conversation about something, and I said, yeah, well, it always appears that the grass is greener on the other side. I use that phrase. He says, yeah, but it's usually because people are watering it. If they sell the plot and you go and buy it, it's not going to remain green. You have to keep up with it. And I thought, wow, what an interesting way of looking at that. The grass may be green on the other side, but that's because somebody put in work. Well, my grass is brown and dead, and every time I step on it, it's crunching. Well, why is their grass green? Because they're putting in work and I'm not. Same thing with a marriage. Well, how come they're always happy and I'm always aggravated and mad? Probably because you're not putting in the work. Verse 21 to 23, the forbidden fountain is a wicked fountain. Verse 21 to 23, for the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. His own iniquities will capture the wicked. He will be held with the cords of his sin, and he will die for a lack of instruction, and the greatness of his folly will go astray. after all of this, he says, this is the ultimate end. You're going to die, and God's going to judge you. Here is what we can take away from this. Verse 21, God will examine what is done in secret. Remember, we think that we got away with it. No. It will come out eventually. Maybe a day, maybe a year. It may be a lifetime. It will come out. And if it doesn't come out in this life, God says, all right, let's bring it to the forefront. Let's talk about it. God will examine what is done in secret. Verse 22, God will expose what is done in secret. Not only will he examine it, he will expose it. You know, the darkness doesn't like the light because it exposes its works, John says. God will say, not only do I remember you doing this and not repenting of it, we're going to talk about this. We're going to bring it up and we're going to talk about it, and you got to think about it for all of eternity. And then finally, verse 23, God will execute what is done in secret. He says, you will die. I have heard many times, and it usually ends with this. I have had a lot of conversations with people who are in adulterous marriages, some of which are in my own family. And the conversations that I've had with them always end with them saying, well, God knows my heart and he just wants me to be happy every time without fail. God wants you to be saved, and he wants you to find joy and happiness in him, not in an unauthorized woman. Well, I'm faithful and I know I'm not perfect, but I keep all the other laws. James says, if you're guilty of one, you're guilty of all. Doesn't matter. You need to be faithful to God and to your spouse. Maybe you're thinking, you know what? You know, I'm faithful to my spouse. I don't look upon another woman. I made a covenant with my eyes, as Job says. So how can I look upon a virgin? Well, maybe it's not your spouse physically that you're cheating on. Maybe it's the groom, Jesus the Christ. Maybe you have broken your vows and you have walked away and said, I want to have an open relationship. I want to have relationship with other gods and goddesses and ways of life. And Jesus says, you can't do that. And you defy the head and you walk away. Well, you know what we read of in the book of Hosea? The very same situation where a woman of harlotry, which is where he actually found his wife, restored and redeemed her to a beautiful position, his wife. And she went around and slept with all kinds of men. And he says, because God told him to, go and take her back. Go buy her back. Maybe you're thinking, I've slept around with too many lifestyles. I've cheated on my groom too many times, and he's not going to take me back. Well, he only will not take you back if you don't go back to him. The father tells his son, you go redeem your bride and buy her back. And that's exactly what he wants to do. Whatever the case may be, I beg and plead that you come now. Together we stand and as we sing.
Is it for me, dear Savior, thy glory and thy rest? For me, the weak